This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Senior Scientist Michael Bentz of the Department of Environmental Quality. He'll have the latest information about air quality awareness in our state and also ozone attainment. And we'll hear from Henry Brancher. He was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 1972, AP Bureau Chief in South Asia. His book is The Dalai Lama's Secret and Other Reporting Adventures. Henry Brancher now calls this area home, and we will talk with him. David Sibley, a well-known ornithologist, nationally recognized, is in our area for an appearance as part of the Baton Rouge Audubon Society. He will talk about birds in this area, and we, of course, we'll talk with him about the controversial study from the Smithsonian about how cats may kill up to 3.7 billion birds a year in the United States. But first, the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with Michael Vince, Senior Environmental Scientist for the Department of Environmental Quality. He's worked for DEQ for 31 years, and he is here to talk about a few items, including May, which is a big month for all of us, and it's, of course, one day away, but it's the start of ozone season. Good morning to you, Michael Vince.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you for having me.
31 years, so you've been with the department, I guess, since its inception.
I was at the department when it actually formed, when Governor Edwards signed the law doing that.
A fellow named Winston Day was the first DEQ secretary.
Yes, he was the interim secretary there.
Yeah, and you've had a few secretaries and a few governors. That would have been during Governor Edwards' third term, I guess, when the department began. Or maybe it was under David Treen, actually.
Treen actually did. So, actually, it became effective then.
Yeah, it was Treen, then Edwards, and then, of course, Romer, then Edwards again, and then Mike Foster and Kathleen Blanco and Bobby Jindal. So you worked with a lot of governors, some of whom have different environmental philosophies. Does that affect DEQ in any way, shape, or form?
I think maybe in some ways it's affected some of the individual programs, but generally speaking, a lot of our activities are driven by federal requirements.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to comply, make sure the state is compliant with federal water quality standards as well as air quality standards. Yeah.
Romer had a scorecard, though. That didn't go over very well with the industry. Was that a good thing for DEQ?
I don't remember too much about the scorecards. I'll have to stay silent
on
that.
Okay, well, we know he did, and he was a guy who made the environment one of his principal issues. It's a big issue in our state. How are we doing?
Well, we're doing really well around the state. We're in attainment for ozone in all the areas of the state except for right here in Baton Rouge. And you know, back at the end of 2011, we actually did reach attainment with one of the prior standards, which was a pretty monumental occasion for us. But EPA lowered that bar, and so the Baton Rouge area now finds itself back in non-attainment status. But we're continuing to work on that.
Well, how have the ozone levels fluctuated in Louisiana, and particularly here in Baton Rouge, over the last few decades?
Well, we've continually brought ourselves down. I mean, the standard keeps changing, and but when we look at our data and compare ourselves on the current standard mm-hmm. to prior year data, we're seeing that we have brought numbers down from 120 parts per billion down to where we're at now, in the 78 to 82 range, somewhere in there.
So you cut it about a third.
Yes, we made some pretty significant strides there.
What does that mean as far as quality of life and danger?
Well, you know, the air quality standards are set to protect the most sensitive part of our population, and that would be people that have respiratory distress, asthma, things like that, as well as young children with developing lungs. And so for those folks, you know, the quality is dramatically improved because the risks have dropped. You know, they're not exposed to as much of that. And the real thing that happens is that when we have a high mm-hmm. ozone day, we caution them just to not go outside, not to engage in activities where they're going to exert themselves a lot and pull a lot of air into their lungs that may bring ozone in there that would affect, you know, conditions that already exist.
So ozone affects people in various ways, but what is the biggest danger for a high ozone level?
Well, I mean, it's just that it's going to exacerbate their conditions, and so if they already, if they're, you know, it could trigger an asthma attack if they're already susceptible, if they're already having some other symptoms, and so clearly we want to avoid doing that, and that's why we have tools out there to help. We do mm-hmm. the air quality forecasting, and we make information available through EnviroFlash.
So long-term exposure, can it cause cancer?
No, long-term exposure will just mean that it will affect the tissues down in the lungs, and so that the lungs won't be able to function properly and won't be able to carry get as much oxygen into the blood.
On the days when we have a high ozone level, what should people do? Should they go out and mow their lawns, take a walk, maybe jog 5 or 6 miles? What should they do?
Well, if we're expecting that a day is going to be a high ozone day, we try to let you know the day before, so that you can plan your activities. And we do suggest that people try to, as much as possible, carpool, put your trips all together. Don't make repeated trips out to the stores. Don't fuel your car during the hottest part of the day or mow grass during the hottest part of the day, because ozone formation occurs, it peaks during the hours of 2 and 4 in the afternoon. So if we can not put pollutants into the air, into the mix, and if that will affect the chemistry.
Now you say you notify the public. I don't think you go to the top of the Capitol and shout that we got high ozone today or tomorrow. So how do you do this?
Well, we have this tool called EnviroFlash, mm-hmm. and people can subscribe to that, and it will send you either a text message or an email, depending on what you want to receive. And we'll send those out, and you get forecast of what tomorrow is going to be. And then if conditions change dramatically, we may send a second notice later or on that next day to tell you that conditions are going to be worse, and this is what you need to do.
And how do people find out about EnviroFlash?
They can go to our website at www.deq.louisiana.gov. and look for the EnviroFlash button on the homepage, or they can go to www.enviroflash.com and sign up right there.
In the state, what are the areas that are most susceptible to high ozone levels? Is it Baton Rouge? Is it Lake Charles? Where are we having the most challenges?
Well, all the areas of the state right now outside of Baton Rouge are meeting the standard. However, as EPA keeps lowering it, and we're expecting later this year we'll get an announcement that that standard will drop even further, that's going to put areas like Lake Charles, Lafayette, New Orleans, and Shreveport potentially out of attainment. And so that's why we have been trying to promote EPA's ADVANCE program to help to get those guys doing things now that will keep them in attainment.
We're talking with Michael Vince, Senior Environmental Scientist for the Department of Environmental Quality. He's been there for 31 years since the DEQ was formed under the administration of David Connor Treen. The last area of the state to meet the 1997 ozone standards was the 5 parish area surrounding Baton Rouge. Why is Baton Rouge a hard area to address as far as compliance?
Well, one thing you have to understand when we talk about the standard is that one part per billion is about the equivalent of one drop of water in an Olympic-sized pool. So when we talk about trying to lower our air quality values here, that's pretty significant when we're only one part per billion away. We have a lot of things in the mix here. We have a lot of petrochemical facilities in our general area. But we are also affected by the coastal breeze that pushes things in. So we receive a lot of nitrogen oxides that roll in off the coast from activities down around Port Fouchon and things like that. So we have to address those things. You know, air pollution doesn't just form and stay in one little place. The air moves constantly, and so all of that movement affects the mm-hmm. chemistry that actually creates ozone in the atmosphere.
What about cars?
Well, cars are a big source of nitrogen oxides, and they're a source that DEQ really doesn't have the authority to regulate. And EPA does that through CAFE standards and efficiency standards on vehicles, as well as changing fuel standards. And so mm-hmm. by doing that, that's where they hope to address that. But definitely The cars make nitrogen oxides. That's one of the components that goes to form ozone. So if we can cut back on emissions there, that can pretty significantly affect what we were doing.
We're talking with Michael Vince, Senior Environmental Scientist for the Department of Environmental Quality. And we're talking about ozone attainment. And, of course, May is the start of the ozone season. It's higher in certain months. Which months are the most prominent?
Well, we start ozone season runs from May through October, and most of our exceedances tend to occur in the early part of that season, in the May-June time frame, and that's because we have a lot of sunlight, and we don't have a lot of the afternoon showers. Mm-hmm. You know, and we start to get into July, we start to get some of those afternoon showers that kind of go and clean things out for us. But because we have a lot of sunlight, we start to get ozone cooking, and it's surprising because you would think that other places might not have an ozone problem, but back in February, areas out in Colorado were having problems. My friends that live in Denver and my friends that live in Salt Lake, Utah, were having difficulty and having ozone exceedances in the wintertime because they didn't have such a bright sun. It wasn't hot, and then they have all these wood fires that release NOx, and so we're not the only ones who are battling this issue.
A couple of statistics provided by DEQ. Driving a motorboat with an outdoor engine for 1 hour may make as much air pollution as driving a late model car for 800 miles. I didn't know that.
That's pretty impressive. You know, but Jim, the thing that I like to let people know that that we can think about in terms of our own lives is that the fuel that we put into our two-cycle engine mm-hmm. equipment, things like weed eaters and blowers and chainsaws, which we use a lot of those here in our climate year-round, about 30% of the fuel that you put into the tank of those engines actually comes back out through the exhaust as a pollutant. So that's pretty impressive when you stop to think about how much is just being released right back into the air.
Impressive in a bad way.
Impressive in a bad way, but it helps us as individuals to realize that I start thinking about what can I do to make a difference, if I can change out when it's time to replace my equipment, if I get some four-cycle mm-hmm. engine equipment that runs more efficiently, less polluting, then I am making a big difference. And if I start to do these things, if I don't mow my lawn every 7 days, but maybe mow my lawn every 9 days or something, over the course of the summer, I will cut out a few of those times I have to mow. And I think mm-hmm. everyone wants to not have to mow quite as often or not as much. But little things like that can make a big difference. And, you know, we call an ozone action day and we think tomorrow might be a bad day, for example. And people take steps, and those days don't always occur.
Okay. Idling your vehicle with the air conditioning on can increase emissions by 13%.
Your car is not very efficient when it's just sitting there idling. And, that's why projects that help to move traffic through town, like synchronization projects and traffic mm-hmm. flow mitigation efforts, those kinds of things really make a big difference.
Do you think we should get these old clunkers that are polluting the air off the roads?
Well, definitely newer cars are more energy efficient, but they're also less polluting. You know, keeping your car, even if it's an older car, keeping it tuned properly, keeping the tires inflated to the right pressures will increase the car's efficiency, and that cuts down on emissions.
Well, it's an interesting time for ozone compliance. Louisiana's come a long ways. How do we still compare with the rest of the country?
Well, you know, with the standard keep going down, down, and down, a lot more areas are going to be brought into this mix of being in non-attainment.
But do we have higher ozone than other neighboring states?
Like, no, the other areas, I mean, you know, the areas around us, Houston, Dallas, Atlanta, those areas.
What about Mississippi and Arkansas, though?
Well, they haven't had problems in the past, except I think Arkansas around the in Crittenden County, which is right across by Memphis, they have issues there, not because of Arkansas activities, I think, more because of what's going on in Memphis. But we do see, you know, they're not like us. We're more like Texas.
Well, if you would like more information from Michael Vince and his staff as far as ozone and the environment. We will provide that when we return after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. And in just a moment, we'll hear from a fascinating gentleman, Henry Bradshaw. He was the Associated Press South Asia correspondent in the 1970s, and Baton Rouge is his home. He's written about his career to some extent. His book is The Dalai Lama's Secret, and it was nice to see Mike Vince from the Department of Environmental Quality. And if you have any questions related to ozone and the environment, the office number there is 225-219-3489. Henry Bradshaw in studio, a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 1972, just 41 years ago.
Long time.
Richard Nixon was riding high, and Henry Kissinger was a prominent man around the world.
And Henry Kissinger was trying to censor some of my reports because they were inconvenient for what he wanted people to believe in Washington.
Why is that guy idolized, considering his sinister past?
That I really don't know. I was spent most of those years abroad in India, in Moscow, in Hong Kong, so I don't know much about what he was doing. But I do know that in several instances reported in my book, he found things I was writing to be the truth that disagreed with what he wanted people to believe in Washington, and so he tried to get my editors not to publish them.
Do you think he was acting at the behest of the president?
He was acting to carry out his own foreign policy. Kissinger very much had his own foreign policy.
Well, Henry Bradshaw, as I noted, lives in Baton Rouge. You actually grew up here, right?
Grew up here. My father's a professor at LSU, but I went to another university. I left when I was 18 and didn't come back till I was 69, gone for 51 years.
And traveled the world and did battle with Henry Kissinger. Did you ever confront him individually, personally, face-to-face?
Oh, yeah. I talked to him. Well, I didn't really confront him. I dealt with him personally on a number of occasions. I was once on Air Force One when Gerald Ford was president, interviewing Gerald Ford as the plane was going between Helsinki and Bucharest. And Kissinger was there, and Kissinger fell asleep. He fell asleep during the interview.
With you?
He fell asleep. I was interviewing Gerald Ford, and Kissinger was sitting in the Air Force One, this compartment where the president's compartment, and Kissinger fell asleep.
Maybe he was tired. You know, he was a busy man.
He had been working hard in Helsinki on the agreement there that I was covering in 1975.
Mm-hmm. And he also dated Jill St. John, so he could have been tired for any number of reasons.
But I guess.
What was it about him that caused you to have a collision as far as your reporting and his interest in representing the president and the government of the United States?
Well, one of the key things was when Kissinger told the public just before the 1972 presidential elections that peace is at hand, and that was based on the assumption that he could get Hanoi and Saigon both to agree to an arrangement he'd worked out to get the United States out of the Vietnam War. But I was in Saigon at that point reporting what the Vietnamese were thinking, and I found very strongly that the Nguyen Van Thieu government in Saigon was not going to accept that agreement, and therefore there was no peace agreement. And in fact, there wasn't. I was reporting that at the time. It all fell apart, which led to the heaviest American bombing of Hanoi that had happened up to then. That was the Christmas 72 bombing. Finally, the agreement was reached in January of 73, but the pretense just before the election, in order to enhance Nixon's reelection campaigns, the pretense that Kissinger had worked out an agreement was false. And I was writing that from Saigon, and Kissinger was calling my editors and saying, oh, don't publish that, it's wrong, or if you're going to publish it, bury it on the back page. Well, in fact, they put it on the front page.
Did he ever apologize?
No. People like that don't apologize.
No, not usually. But this was 1972, and whatever Kissinger was doing, it worked. Richard Nixon carried 49 states, beat the devil out of George Stanley.
Yeah, I wasn't involved in domestic American politics.
Your reporting certainly had an impact.
I was reporting what was going on during the Bangladesh War, 1971, which I predicted and then covered from front to end. There, again, Kissinger didn't like what I was reporting. That's another chapter in my book, the whole Bangladesh War episode that I've spent a lot of time on.
Well, there are now reports that Nixon and his minions may have actually interfered with the Paris peace talks in 1968.
There are such reports, but I was in Moscow at that time as Associated Press bureau chief. looking at things, reporting things from the Soviet standpoint, and didn't actually, I have no first-hand knowledge of that. I was busy reporting on Soviet affairs.
For over a quarter of a century, Henry Bradshaw reported stories from around the world, and you've heard some of the places he's been. He's been practically everywhere, including the battlefields of Vietnam. How was that experience?
Well, one gets out. I was not one of these jungle slogging correspondents who spent a lot of time out in the field. I did a little of it in Vietnam, in Cambodia. There are separate chapters in my book discussing each of those. But my main job was describing the overview of how things were going militarily, how they were going politically, how they were going economically. And this was a situation, this was a time when it was difficult to see any real hope in Vietnam or in Cambodia, which, of course, this was before the Khmer Rouge period, when the Khmer Rouge killed off so many people.
Mm-hmm. 1959. How old were you at that time?
59, I would have been 28 years old. I was just 27 when I first went out to India as an AP correspondent, and I got there just before the Dalai Lama fled from Tibet into exile in India. I was there when all that happened. And some exciting episodes during that period.
I guess that prompted the title of the book from LSU Press, The Dalai Lama's Secret.
The title of the book is based really upon not when the Dalai Lama first fled. That was an interesting episode involving a lot of hijinks by some other reporters and some disreputable reporting. But it came later when it turned out that the Dalai Lama had sent a treasure. His valuables from the Potala, his palace in Lhasa, had been sent out in 1951 and hidden across the border in Sikkim, a little state which is now part of India. And these treasures were not known to anyone, and then finally they were moved in 1961 when after he'd come out, they were moved into the Bank of India, and I found out about this and reported it. It was a secret.
297-5633. Your number, Henry Bradshaw, the guest, a man who has been around the world and back, lives in Baton Rouge, a 51-year gap between his first visit here and his last, and it may not be his last. You've got a few years left. Obviously, this man is still on top of his game, and he's written about his experiences in the Dalai Lama's Secret and other reporting adventures, stories from a Cold War correspondent, Henry S. Bradshaw from LSU Press. He won the George Polk Award for Foreign Reporting in 1973 and was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for International Reporting in 1972. Where did you go to school, Henry?
I went to the University of Missouri.
Fine journalism school?
Yeah, I got journalism, but I also got a separate degree in history and economics.
And then I guess that was around the Korean War.
I finished during the Korean War with an ROTC commission and then spent 3 years in the Air Force before I became a reporter.
Mm-hmm. What's the most interesting place you've been?
You know, a lot of people ask me that. They've all been interesting in their time and place. When I first went out to Delhi as a young bachelor, I wandered all over South Asia, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, so forth. That was great fun. And then after I'd been there 4.5 years, a young lady came out as a Fulbright scholar, and I married her there. So that, some ways, was the highlight.
Where is she from?
She was from the Chicago area. And then we went off to Moscow, spent 4.5 years in Moscow, and incurred the wrath of the Soviet authorities.
What years were you in Moscow?
Early 64 to late 68. Mm-hmm. And I'm the only Westerner who's known to have had his car blown up by a KGB bomb. Just a little symbol of the fact that they were not happy with me.
Were they trying to kill you?
No, we'd parked the car. It was Christmas night, 1967. We'd parked the car by our apartment building, and they put the bomb under it just as a sort of a message. They'd already gotten
nice gift.
Unhappy with me.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah, Merry Christmas is right. Yeah.
So what caused that?
I had been reporting how things really were. I didn't pull any punches. Some journalists in Moscow pulled their punches. Some didn't. I didn't pull any punches. I had given what I thought were fair evaluations, mm-hmm. and they had gotten more and more unhappy with me. I didn't let that scare me out. I was there for another 8 or 9 months after that, but I had already applied for a fellowship at Harvard, which I got, so I left finally for that.
You've had an interesting life, Henry Bradshaw.
And then spent the 5 years. During the time I went to Vietnam and Cambodia, I was based in Hong Kong and was primarily a specialist on Chinese affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chinese didn't like that either, because I was saying there was struggle in China that they were denying, but finally it came out it was true.
Mm-hmm. When you stayed in these places, did you have first-class accommodations?
No. First 3.5 years in India, I lived in a utilitarian hotel room, but then I had an apartment by the time my future wife came along. Moscow was difficult because the Soviet government in those days assigned housing to foreigners, and you took what you got, and it wasn't very good.
Moscow, in the Cold War, that must have been an interesting time. This was when the Soviets invaded Czechoslovakia.
Right. I was just leaving Moscow to take up my Harvard fellowship when the Soviets went into the Czech Republic. That's
mm-hmm.
right.
And that went on for many years, and you hung up your reporting credentials as an everyday reporter in what year?
Well, in 19, I had left the Associated Press and was working for the Washington Star, a newspaper that was in Hong Kong, and then later as a diplomatic correspondent in Washington, traveling all over the world for them. They went out of business in 1981, an afternoon paper. Big city afternoon mm-hmm. papers have died all over the world. Well, look at the State Times here. We're not a big city
right.
in Baton Rouge, but it died.
So you spanned Eisenhower to Reagan.
That's right.
Presidents, huge men historically, mm-hmm. Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Reagan. Who were the most impressive?
The ones I actually had personal contact with, I had no contact with Eisenhower. I had contact with Johnson, none with Kennedy. I was overseas the years Kennedy was president. A little bit with Nixon later, traveled with Nixon, and traveled with Ford. Carter, traveled with Carter a lot on his Middle East negotiations particularly. They were impressive in different ways. Each had his own qualities.
Did you have a personal favorite?
I still think Carter did a better job than most people are inclined nowadays to give him credit for.
We're talking foreign policy now. His domestic policy left much to be desired, according to most historians, but it's curious that you would choose him because, as I said, you worked with some giants during the time of many legendary American presidents. Jimmy Carter is not the stuff of legends.
I worked with him in terms of foreign policy, and I thought he did a good job on foreign policy. I was never a domestic policy reporter.
Mm-hmm. When you were overseas and Nixon was immersed in the Watergate scandal, how was that being played abroad? What was the sentiment in other parts of the world about Nixon going down over Watergate?
It got a lot of attention in East Asia, which is where I was at that time. But most people I talked to were sort of astounded that this kind of thing could happen. They never expected it to happen to an American president. Of course, most Americans never expected it either.
Ted Koppel writes of his friend, Henry Bratcher. He says of his book, The Dalai Lama's Secret, "Ah, the memories, not the least of them. How glorious the profession of journalism was when foreign correspondents like Henry S. Bratcher roamed the earth." You couldn't text it or tweet it in those days. It might be days between the writing and the reading of a story, but they were made to last. These remain great, most of a lifetime after they were first reported. The process of reporting has certainly changed because of the technology. Is it been changed for the good or for
It's
not
certainly
so good?
Quicker, but in some ways that undercuts the ability to think carefully about what you're reporting. Now, my elder son is now the Hong Kong bureau chief for the New York Times. And as a matter of fact, he was part of a Times team that won a Pulitzer Prize this year. And he is able to get stories immediately by computer back to his desk, and in some cases call by cell phone to update a story. Whereas when I first went overseas, when I went out to India, you had to find a telegraph office and slap something that you'd written on a typewriter on the desk and get them to eventually send it.
Your son must have been inspired by your experiences.
He thought about other careers, but he liked this one, and he's been very successful and enjoyed his work now.
And how old is he?
He's now, well, let me see. We married almost 49 years ago. We married almost 50 years ago, so he's almost 49. He was born a year after we were married.
So he's right in his prime in Hong Kong.
Hong Kong bureau chief for the New York Times. That's right.
That's strong stuff. Newspapers are struggling, including the New York Times. I saw last year their ad revenues are down 10%. They even have front page ads now. Saw one for Cartier last Friday in front page of the New York Times.
Yeah.
What do you think of the landscape of journalism right now?
landscape of journalism has changed. Too much of what people talk about as journalism, I do not consider journalism. I think of journalism as collecting information and relaying it to people. A lot of what passes for journalism I call show business. It's shouting opinions back and forth, mm-hmm. or picking out things that suit one man's opinion and trying to pass it off as news without giving a total balanced account of things. Written journalism still tends to be, in most cases, I think, very good, but a lot of what passes for broadcast journalism is show business.
Who are the best journalists of your day?
Well, I've always admired people like John Burns of the New York Times. I knew him as a young man when he first went out to China as a foreign correspondent for a Canadian paper. He's been with the New York Times for many years now and is currently their London bureau chief. He's one of the best. There are a number of other very good ones practicing right now. I wouldn't try to pick out any particular ones.
But in your day, you worked with some people who had long and successful careers, famous people. And that seems to be one of the perils of journalism, is that sometimes the journalists become more famous than the people they're covering. That's not the way it's supposed to work.
That is part of what I call the show business aspect of it and not journalism itself.
How do we get around that, or can we?
I'm not sure we can anymore. Too many people want celebrity news. They don't want news specifically of what's going on in the world. They're not interested in what's happening in Syria, whether the Syrian regime is busy slaughtering people or using poison gas. They're not interested in this kind mm-hmm. of thing. And it's understandable. People are interested in local bread and butter issues. The Advocate here in Baton Rouge is quite right to put legislative news on the front page and foreign news on page two or inside. Nonetheless, people need to know what's going on in the world.
Bernard Kalb, who endorses your book, the former New York Times and CBS and NBC journalist, says you, Henry Brancher, are a veteran of the endangered species known as foreign correspondents. Are foreign correspondents going away?
Not many organizations maintain foreign correspondents anymore. When I was overseas in the 60s and 70s, there were big news bureaus from a lot of organizations which no longer have news bureaus, which no longer maintain foreign correspondents. You nowadays get what I call in the book parachute journalism, and that is dropping your star reporter into a place where there's a big story, but he has no background. He doesn't understand the situation. He's just giving you the top of the news. You need long-term people who get to know places. As the book explains, I sort of accidentally spent about 5 years in each of three places, New Delhi, Moscow, and Hong Kong, and then many years in Washington traveling elsewhere. That gave me a chance to understand the local situations.
The book is The Dalai Lama's Secret and Other Reporting Adventures, stories from a Cold War correspondent, Henry S. Brancher from LSU Press. And he is a man who covered the news around the world, involved with people like Khrushchev and Brezhnev and Nixon and Ford and Carter and Reagan and Sadat and Begin. He's seen a lot of things, and much of it is reported right here in his book, The Dalai Lama's Secret. Thank you, Henry. Let's do this again. You're a captivating man, so I look forward to talking with you more about your life and times and contemporary happenings as well. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jim.
And congratulations on the book. We will visit with well-known ornithologist David Sibley when we return after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing, and our guest at this time is David Allen Sibley, a well-known American ornithologist who is soon to be in our community as a guest of the Baton Rouge Audubon Society. He'll be speaking May 2nd. That's Thursday night, 7 o'clock at the LSU Energy Coast and Environment Building. So you can get to meet this fine gentleman. Good morning to you, David Sibley.
Good morning.
Nice to talk with you, David. And you're a man who comes from a family of ornithologists. Your father was one of the best in the world, Fred Sibley. I'm sure that influenced your interest during childhood and beyond.
Yeah, I'm sure it did. I always had an interest in birds, and whether that came naturally or from my father and the people he was working with and all the bird books and bird stuff around the house, or maybe it's a combination of my own interest and the the environment that he provided in the house. But I have loved birds as long as I can remember.
You've cited the European wildlife artist Lars Jonsson as a great influence on your work.
Yeah. Yeah, he's, I think, the best best bird illustrator out there. And I discovered his books when I was about 22, 23 years old and just devoured them. I spent hours looking at the paintings and studying his technique and learning as much as I could from those published illustrations.
As you know, we have a rich history of bird watching and bird enthusiasts and historians here in Louisiana. We're right at the forefront on this, going back to Mr. Audubon.
Yep.
What does that do as far as bringing you here and in the interest that people have regarding your work and your predecessors?
Oh, well, Audubon is just as everyone knows the name Audubon, he's just a giant of American ornithology. And I have to confess, when I was younger, I didn't really appreciate his work. When I was in my teens and 20s, I thought his paintings were sort of old-fashioned and stiff and contrived, and I didn't, as a young upstart, I had no time for that. So, but I've come to appreciate his work so much, and a lot of it started about 15 or 20 years ago. I started reading some of his journals. He wrote prolifically, and his writing is, some of it's about birds and bird painting. A lot of it is just the things he was seeing and the people he was meeting. And he's got some fantastic descriptions of life in Louisiana in the early 1800s and the characters that he met. There's a story about him walking along the river, meeting a man who was dressed in a multicolored coat and with a parrot on his shoulder, and he invited Audubon back to his house, and they practiced shooting indoors. And he's great, great stories, but his accomplishment in his paintings, you start to get a feeling for that when you think about 1810, there were no binoculars, no cameras, no other published books that he could look at to learn about birds. And he's traveling by horseback with nothing but a box of art supplies and a shotgun. And that was his bird study. For 20 years he traveled and just painted birds.
Well, you are an expert of contemporary nature and the author of The Sibley Guide to Birds, author and illustrator, considered by some to be the most comprehensive guide for North American field identification. And come Thursday, when David will be at the Coast of Energy Coast and Environment Building at LSU, you'll talk about some of the shortcuts that birders use to identify birds. How do they do that?
Yeah, it's something I've always been interested in it, sort of how the brain works, and it's a question that I considered a lot as I was working on the field guide. It's sort of the fundamentals of how we process information to identify birds, and thinking about that in the sense of how to present the information in the book. But it's a lot of basic stuff about how our brains work, and I apply it directly to bird identification, but you can apply it to anything. Basically, when you wake up in the morning and you look outdoors and the tops of the trees are, you see the trees swaying, you assume that it's wind. You don't assume that there's, you know, a dragon flying by and moving the tops of the trees with the air from its wings. We make these assumptions all the time, and we have to, of course. You can't examine every everything you see objectively and consider every alternative. We're making all kinds of assumptions about what we see. And it happens in very subtle and very specific ways. And it's easy to get off on the wrong track to make one of these assumptions that's not right and find yourself down the wrong path. And it can be very difficult then to get back on the right path, because your brain then starts processing the information based on that assumption and even alters your perception to better fit that assumption.
The author, ornithologist, and illustrator David Sibley with us for a few more moments, and as noted, he will be at the LSU Energy Coast and Environment Building Thursday night at 7 o'clock to talk more. And through the last few months, we've had some listeners who have commented on the air and off regarding this story from the study from the Smithsonian about how cats in the United States, outdoor cats, may kill up to 3.7 billion birds in the U.S. every year. Do you have any thoughts regarding this, David?
Oh, yeah, that's a very serious issue, a very contentious issue. I own a cat myself, and I like cats, but I know that cats are a very serious problem for birds. They're such predators. That's in their nature. Cats are predators, and they will eat birds. They'll catch and eat birds, even when they're being fed and cared for by people, like the cats, that is.
What should be done about outdoor cats, if anything?
I think there should be an effort to control feral cats, that we should not have wild cats living out in natural areas. They're an introduced predator, and they do a lot of damage to the native wildlife.
But you just said that even well-kept and well-fed cats are still prone to kill and eat birds. Should cats be barred from being outside?
I guess that I don't think that's realistic. That would be best for birds, but I don't think that's a step that's realistic. I do think that cats are making people aware of these issues is probably one of the most important steps. The cats that are actually kept indoor or kept by people and fed and cared for in suburban neighborhoods are doing less damage than the cats that are living out in the wilds and not being fed. So the first priority is to control the feral cats that are out there.
Well, as we know, when we speak of activists, there are more cat organizations than there are bird organizations. Some of our listeners say somebody needs to speak up for the songbirds, and it would seem that you might be the guy to do that as one of the foremost bird authority in the United States right now.
Yeah, there's more. There are some well-organized cat advocacy groups, but there's more and more people speaking out in support of the birds, and more of these studies coming out that are documenting the damage that cats are doing. There's a group called the American Conservancy based in Washington that's been very active and supporting the bird conservation and talking about cats for a long time. So they're really at the forefront and doing a lot of work on behalf of birds on this issue.
David Allen Sibley, the ornithologist and the author of the Sibley Guide to Birds, considered to be perhaps the top guide for North American field identification, will be in Baton Rouge at Louisiana State University Thursday night, 7 o'clock at the Coast Environment Building. And we thank you for joining us today, David Allen Sibley. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Appreciate it. Have a good trip. And as we wrap up the hour, it should be noted, one of the top stories, in fact, the story that is above the fold in Tuesday, April 30th's edition of the Baton Rouge Advocate. By the way, the anniversary of Louisiana State University is today, as well as the anniversary of the state of Louisiana, founded in 1812. We're now 201 years old. LSU football coach Les Miles has indefinitely suspended star running back Jeremy Hill 2 days after Hill's arrest for an alleged role in a fight at an off-campus bar. Does this sound familiar? Baton Rouge police report disclosed additional details of the fight at Reggie's Bar in Tigerland over the weekend, reporting that Hill and a second man exchanged a high five after attacking a man from behind. Now, Jeremy Hill of Redemptorist High School has been in trouble before, was the leading rusher in the spring game with 103 yards on 13 carries. Last year as a freshman, he gained 755 yards and scored 12 touchdowns. He is a top-flight player, considered to be one of the major contributors if he is eligible in 2013, and we'll find out what will happen in the next 4 months as LSU opens its season August 31st at Dallas against TCU. Will Jeremy Hill be in the lineup? And if this were his first fracas, maybe people would not be reacting as they are, but some folks are hot and bothered. The video, by the way, according to reports, shows Hill punching a 20-year-old male victim behind his left ear as the victim was walking away, then shows the second man delivering a blow that knocked the victim unconscious, and then it shows Hill and the other man reportedly high-fiving about their work. Well, Hill faces simple battery charges. East Baton Rouge DA Hiller Moore says it's possible the charges against Hill could be upgraded, but says simple battery is probably the appropriate charge based on, quote, what I've seen right now. Well, simple battery is a misdemeanor, meaning that Hill is right now not facing the felony charges that Jordan Jefferson did 2 years ago when he got involved in a off-campus fight at Shady's Bar, and Jefferson was suspended. Hill has been suspended, and this comes on the heels of him pleading guilty in January of last year, just, 15 months ago, to misdemeanor carnal knowledge of a juvenile after Hill and another student engaged in a sexual act with a 14-year-old girl in the school's locker room, his high school at Redemptorist. He was sentenced to 6 months of suspended jail time, and a condition of his probation was that he refrain from all criminal conduct. He's a young man who's had a checkered past, and some would say good riddance, and this is a kind of publicity that LSU does not want or need at a time when the university is fighting for every dollar it can get from the state legislature and the football team as the most prominent entity on campus. What does this say about what is going on within that program? And there have been other problems. As we noted, the incident 2 years ago at Shady's regarding the quarterback Jordan Jefferson. Josh Johns, a reserve linebacker, also was charged. Charges later dropped against him. And Jefferson and the Honey Badger, Tyrann Mathieu, who was kicked off the team last year, were later arrested on marijuana charges at a apartment near campus, across the street from Louis Cafe. And the publicity surrounding this team nationwide is now quite often more prominent for off-the-field activities than it is for the Tigers' substantial on-the-field success. In his 8 years as head coach, nobody has won more games in his first 8 years, nobody even close, than Leslie Edwin Miles. But right now, he faces a crisis within his program about whether there is institutional control, and he has taken swift action by suspending running back Jeremy Hill. And we shall see, and we'll talk about this in the next 4 months, as to whether Hill will ultimately be reinstated and be in the starting lineup in time for LSU's opener against Texas Christian. Michael Bonnet, LSU's sports information director, says we're not going to make it an ongoing dialogue in the media. Coach Miles, will let it play out through the legal system before he comments any further. So this is where it is right now, and I would imagine that at some point soon the cell phone video will probably be released, and the other gentleman who is allegedly involved in this incident will be known and perhaps also charged with criminal charges. So we shall follow it, and we thank you for joining us today. Hope you have a great time, and we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.